welcome to Education Currents, a show designed to provide current educational news and commentary from a Christian worldview. The greatest resource any community has is its children, and by providing for them the best possible education, we are providing for ourselves and future generations. Join us as we explore the latest social and political issues surrounding education. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rose Gamblin and Paul Tulin.
Well, I have a real treat for you today. We are going to go to a history expo put on by a local elementary school. It's Mount Etna Adventist Elementary School, and it's located in Maryland. And I hope you enjoy, as I have enjoyed, interviewing these young people in character. Well, hi. Abby Adams is here with us in the studio today. Abby, we have been wanting to know about what a young lady, what the impact that she would have during your time on the White House.
Well, when my husband was president, there was no thing where women have anything to do with, like, politics, like voting or anything. So while my husband was president and he was away, I would always write him letters and try to advise him on stuff to do, since I couldn't really do anything else, and he would listen to me and try to do what I said. So in a way, I kind of started the path for women to be able to vote and have other rights.
And what was your time frame?
From the late 1700s to the early 1800s.
Okay, so as you started out your life, did you ever expect to be the wife of a president of the United States?
Probably not.
How many children did you have?
I had 6 kids. 2 of them died before they reached adulthood.
Okay. And did you have any of them during your husband's presidency?
No, all before.
So you brought them all with you to the White House. Describe to us a little bit about how the White House looked or some of the ways that you had to manage that big house.
Well, I was the first lady ever to live in the White House. It was called the President's House, though, at the time. And I think both of my younger sons came with me. My older children were already, some of them were married, some of them were away. So my 2 younger sons came with me, and we didn't really have to do very much. We had servants and stuff like that.
And so, but you had to manage the servants or tell them what to do.
Yes.
And at that point, I imagine you were having state dinners and some functions there as well.
Yes, I love to entertain people. So.
Well, that was perfect.
Yes.
So talking to our young girls that are listening, what words of advice from Abby Adams would you give?
Well, I like to tell them that if they want to do something, then try hard to try to be able to do whatever they want to do.
That goes great with that verse, whatever thy hand finds to do, do it with all of thy might. Well, thank you so much for being with us, and we hope to catch up with you later.
Okay.
There's George Custer. Hey, come and talk to us. George Custer from Custer's Last Stand. Tell us about how you came to be such a famous historical figure.
Okay, since I was 4, my father, he would dress me in a soldier's uniform because he was in the town militia, so that inspired me to be just like him, a soldier. So I went to military academy for college. I graduated in 1861. Since the Civil War was going on, I entered that immediately. I fought in the 7th Cavalry for the Union. My first battle was the First Battle of Bull Run. We lost that battle, but we ended up winning the war. And then I fought in the Indian Wars, which was when we would try to keep the Indians on their reservations, because, you know, like, to contain them.
Yeah.
But they wanted to come out, so we'd have to fight them to keep them back on. My first battle was the Battle of Washita. It was a long time ago, so I'm iffy, so I don't really remember it. And then, my second battle in the Indian Wars was the Battle of Little Bighorn. So, me and my 600 men, we're cavalry, so we rode on horses. We were scouting the area to see if we could find any horses. And we found a group of 40 Sioux warriors, which is, like, you know, scouting their area, too. So I was thinking, oh, they see us. If we don't kill them, they're going to alert the main group. So I went after them, and I saw a village. I'm like, oh, this isn't very big. So I cut my army in half. One under Marcus Rano to attack the north side, and I was going to attack the south. So he went. And as he was fighting, They had 1,800 men. And the village, which was much bigger, it stretched for miles. So he was butchered. He was killed. And meanwhile, I was coming from the south side, and they saw me coming, and so they formed me into an envelope, and I had like 175 men. They had 1,800. So I told my men to shoot their horses, because this is a hopeless situation. And I fought for an hour, and then we finally pulled back.
So did you have a family?
Yes, I had a wife back in Ohio, where I was born, New Rumley.
Okay. So as we conclude our little time with you, can you just tell us maybe about some of the equipment you were wearing or the type of horse you had?
Well, I had a very fast horse, but I forget his name. And I had a rifle, and I would wear sometimes a buckskin jacket with a cowboy hat and boots. And I was in the 7th Cavalry. I had like 600 men. And I would go around killing Indians to keep them on the reservations.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brave and reckless. And many times I would put my men into very dangerous situations. Like in the Battle of Little Bighorn, I should have scouted the area to know that I was severely outmanned. But I didn't, and that caused a very large amount of casualties.
Yes, and I think the lesson that our listeners can take from this is know who you're up against. Know your foe. I mean, of course, we know we're up against Satan, but we also, he has agents working around, and we need to be smart. We need to be smart. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It was my pleasure. I need to go and gather my men, so.
Okay, thank you. Bye. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to a notorious character. You won't want to miss this, so stay tuned to find out who it is.
You know what really grinds my gears? Today's rap game, hip-hop, how it's so polluted because it has so much nasty talk and how much rappers talk about sex, drugs, partying, making women sound like they're just objects and tools. Well, I feel like there's only a handful of rappers that embrace hip-hop and make it something to enjoy. Like, for instance, Kendrick Lamar, who talks about things in life like God, his life growing up, and also struggle that he's been through. Not because he's from the hood or anything, it's just he talks about how he came up and how he's doing now. Thank you.
This teen topic was written and produced by a student from Highland View Academy. For more information about Highland View Academy, go to www.hva-edu.com.
Hello, today's topic is about weddings. I know it may seem strange to some people for a 17-year-old to be obsessed with weddings, and yes, I'm obsessed. I watch so many wedding shows and movies, it's crazy. And many don't know this about me, but I love collecting wedding magazines and planners just because. I love looking at the wedding dresses and decorations that people put in their weddings. Some are good, and some are really interesting. But lately, I have found that my obsession will be useful because my aunt is getting married. So she gives me ideas, and I hunt for what she may like in her wedding. So honestly, I have learned that sometimes obsessions can be bad, but on rare occasions such as this, they can be useful.
This teen topic was written and produced by a student from Highland View Academy. For more information about Highland View Academy, go to www.hva-edu.com. That's www.hva-edu.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Education Currents, and we're doing a history expo. Our characters today are students from the Mount Etna Adventist Elementary School. And without any further ado, we're going to welcome the next character. I have with me Mary Surratt. Now, you're a pretty notorious character. Tell us a little bit about your life leading up to what we're going to talk about today.
Well, when I was younger, I went to a Catholic boarding school until I was age 17. After I went to the boarding school, I ended up being a Catholic the rest of my life. I always wore black. I always wore a veil over my face. And I married a man named John Harrison Surratt, and we built a house. But that house ended up catching on fire, so we moved to Virginia, and we built another house. We had three kids there, Isaac Surratt, Anna Surratt, and John Surratt Jr. We made a town out of our house, and we called it Surrattsville. We had a tavern, which we charged 25 cents a night for. We had a stable, we had a post office, and pretty much all kinds of different things that people would have in a town. My husband was the postmaster until he died of alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And my
That must have been devastating.
Yeah, because he left me, not just because, but he left me in a lot of debt. He went out and bought a lot of beer and stuff, so I did not have that much money. And both my sons at this time had been fighting for the Confederacy. My son Isaac, my firstborn, was fighting in Texas for the Confederacy, and my son John Surratt Jr. was a courier. And, well, I had called for him to come back since my husband had died, and he was my postmaster for a little while until the Union soldiers found out that he had been transporting secret stuff and things that are not supposed to be transported, like guns and ammunition, through the post office because he was the postmaster. So they took out him and put a Union soldier in there.
Mm.
By this time, I did not have any money. So I rented out the tavern to a man named John Lloyd, and we moved to Washington, D.C., where we built a house, and it ended up being our boarding house.
Now, when you have a house in Washington, D.C., but yet it sounds like you were for the South.
Yes.
So is this what led to the next stage of your life?
Yes, it was. Of course, I'm living in the northern part of the country, and some people refer to me as the Confederate spy that went undercover into Northern Territory.
So you're notorious because of what happens next.
Yes.
Just briefly tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was a conspirator with the other 9 people that tried to kill Abraham Lincoln. We weren't only trying to kill Abraham Lincoln, though. We were trying also, besides him, we were trying to kill Vice President Andrew Johnson, the Secretary of State William Seward, the Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, and General Ulysses S. Grant.
Why weren't you able to carry the whole mission off?
Well, we had different people assigned to different parts. We had a man named George Adsarot, who was supposed to go and kill the vice president. But he went and got drunk in a bar because he couldn't get up his confidence and was seen wandering the streets of Washington. He was later caught because they found a Bowie knife, a gun, and ammunition under his mattress.
Mm. So tell us about what your responsibilities were.
My responsibilities were to keep things like guns and ammunition, packages, all hidden in my tavern, which was in Surrattsville, which John Lloyd helped me in these cases, but he never was caught. In fact, he testified against me at my trial.
So tell us a little bit about your trial. I mean, where I know we're coming to the conclusion of your life, so to speak, but tell us a little bit about your trial.
Well, when I got caught, and mainly, no offense to my daughter, but I got caught because she was smitten with John Wilkes Booth and had a picture hidden behind our family photo.
Oh, dear.
And the soldiers caught it. So I got captured by the Union soldiers, and I ended up being taken to prison. And I was so depressed that I would not eat anything. I kept my veil over my face all the time, and it was very hot, so I was very pale and very fragile. When I went to court, the court was mainly Union soldiers, and I figured that all they wanted was revenge. Mm-hmm. And my lawyer, Frederick Aiken, tried to help me get a jury by my peers,
mm-hmm.
by a citizen courtship, but the government would not allow it because apparently they had too much evidence against me, but I figured that it wasn't true. All they wanted was revenge because we ended up killing Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Well, what final words would you say to our listeners when it comes to this story of someone who really you were fighting for what you thought was right?
Well, I figure that we wanted to make sure the Confederacy had a chance to rise, which is the reason we were going after the government anyway, was so that the Confederacy would have a chance. I would tell our listeners that don't try to cheat for something. Just keep going, even if it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we will certainly try to catch up with you later.
Oh, well, thank you. I have to cook dinner for my daughter anyway.
Okay, talk to you later.
Thank you.
Davy Crockett, I'm so glad to meet you.
Thank you, and you too.
Now, tell me a little bit about some of your adventures. What is the most important adventure you can think of?
The most important adventure I can think of is when I was going through the backwoods of Alabama, and at times I would walk through swarms of flying insects of types like mosquitoes and gnats and other...
Ouch.
Yeah. And I got malaria.
Now, why were you in Alabama?
I was going through there looking for some land, I believe, with a couple of friends of mine, and I went off to look for, like, food, hunting.
Oh, yes. I suppose most of your food you had to hunt and find yourself.
Yes. Yes, I did. So I was looking for food. I got lost, being that I didn't know that area very well. And I got malaria. And I realized that, and to keep myself, like, conscious, I would climb up a tree, and then I'd drop down on the bark. So to, yeah.
So did is that the normal way that they treated malaria in those days?
No.
But you probably didn't have any quinine or anything available.
No, not really. I did that to keep myself conscious, but yeah.
You could have knocked yourself unconscious. Tell me about some of the weaponry you carried.
I would carry usually a flintlock rifle, and I named it Betsy because it was given to me by friends in Philadelphia when I was a congressman running for Congress.
Wow, yeah. What a rich life, going from Congress to Alabama woods.
Yeah, it was interesting. While I was a congressman, I was an anti-Jacksonian going against President Jackson, and I tried repealing the Indian Removal Act, and I voted against it, but so many people voted for it that my vote really didn't do anything.
So you carried a rifle? Is that what that is?
Yes.
And did you carry a knife?
I did.
And describe a little bit your garb.
Well, I would usually wear buckskin clothing, shirt, and pants, and I would wear a coonskin hat on my head.
Coonskin, yes.
Yeah.
So what do you want our listeners to go away with about Davy Crockett? What's the most important thing that he brought to our history?
Well, I would say my stories of my adventures, which are very many, and I wouldn't have time to tell, and my helping defend the Alamo in, like, San Antonio, Texas.
The Alamo is synonymous with Davy Crockett, for sure, for
yes,
sure.
It is.
Well, it's been so great having you visit with us here at our History Expo. I imagine you probably have something you need to do.
Yes, thank you. I have to go get back to fighting now.
Okay, so we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Goodbye.
I am so honored to have with me here Dr. Martin Luther King. Welcome, Dr. King. How are you today? We're so glad to have you on Homeschool Companion.
I'm doing pretty fantastic. Thank you.
So as a young boy, what were some of the things that prompted you to become this great figure in social justice?
Well, it's actually a pretty funny story. When I was little, I was not interested in God or becoming a pastor at all, much like my father. But my father was a pastor of a Baptist church, and he wanted me to take over the church when I became older. But as I grew older, the times were changing, and I didn't really want to become more interested in God and things like that. But it was after my grandma died suddenly that I became more subtle and very actually depressed. I actually tried killing myself by jumping out of a two-story window. It didn't work, and then I kind of realized my purpose in life, and I became devoted to becoming a pastor, and I actually graduated high school at age 15.
Wow. So you're a pastor, and we often don't realize this aspect of Martin Luther King, that he was a pastor first.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Was there a turning point in his experience where he realized that somebody needed to stand for the rights of the African-American population?
Well, Oh, see, that's kind of difficult because there were many organizations before the one I joined, NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. There were many different organizations before that, but none of the ones before that had really got anywhere to get the African Americans their rights. But I believe that the NAACP, that organization, there were many remarkable men in that organization that really helped get things done.
So tell me about the decision to do the Freedom Rides.
Well, Let's see here. There was the bus boycott. That happened in about 1955. It started in Alabama. We decided that all the African Americans would try to not ride the local or the city buses at all. And we actually did that for at least 2 years. But instead of riding the buses, we carpooled, we walked, we did anything we could to get to work and back. Anything but riding the buses, because African Americans were the main source of the money. They were money-making machines for mm-hmm. the bus, because most of them couldn't afford cars at that time. So we did that for about 2 years. We wanted to get the rights to be able to sit on segregated buses without having a white man come up to us and say, "Get out of your seat. I want that seat." And so finally, after about 2 years, the Congress said, "Okay, this is enough. We need to make money again." So they finally gave us that right.
So leading up to, we know ultimately, his death, can you lead us into that?
Well, it's pretty ironic. It all started from the very beginning. I mean, there were many people who had attempted to kill me. Their people bombed my house. They tried to throw things at me. I mean, and even words are like daggers mm-hmm. in one, so determined to make a difference. Mm-hmm. But somehow, I believe God really led me through this. I mean, if it hadn't been for him, I probably wouldn't have been able to do a lot of things. People have attempted to kill me many times, but I think a tragedy was when I was signing books. I wrote 5 books in my lifetime. When I was signing books in a department store, an African-American lady came up to me and said, "Are you Dr. King?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And then she cursed at me and stabbed a letter opener into my chest. I later found out that the letter opener cut many veins that led to my heart, and I almost died. And that was one of the darkest moments in my life. Mm. But after I recovered, I became more determined. I went on many marches and gave many speeches, much like I Have a Dream speech. That's probably the most mm-hmm. familiar one that I've done. I went on marches, and I decided to go to Memphis, Tennessee, where they were going to hold a march. And I was leaning over the balcony to talk with some friends below on the bottom floor, and a man named James Earl Ray shot me in the head, and I died immediately.
Mm. Well, your legacy continues to go on, and we so appreciate you coming and talking to us about Dr. Martin Luther King. And I'm sure you have something that you need to do or some final words that you'd like to say to us.
Yes, of course. And one of my favorite quotes that I say many times is, remember, faith is taking the first step, even if you don't see the whole staircase.
Amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to these young people as much as I have. In fact, not one of these students had any notes or prompts. They had learned enough about their character that we could just have these spontaneous conversations. Now, to me, that's an example of mastery learning. Our History Expo is going to continue this week on Homeschool Companion. Homeschool Companion airs on most stations at 11:05 Eastern Standard Time, but you might need to check your local listing. Or you can go to the web at LTR, which stands for lifetalkradio.streamon.fm. So you'd put in http://LTR.streamon.fm.
You've been listening to Education Currents, a production of MRG Media. We're now on Facebook, and we'd love to have you join our discussion. Once you're in Facebook, just type in the name Education Currents. We'll also like to thank our production staff, the various networks that make this broadcast possible. For more information on education topics, go to educationcurrents.com. That's educationcurrents.com.